Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading the Midland Reporter Telegram for Saturday, December 4th, 2021, weekend edition, Section A. Officers, expert, take stand for prosecution. Human errors on display during fourth day of Wilson trial. By Iris Foster. Human errors were repeatedly on display during day four of the trial of David Wilson, stemming from the fatal shooting of MPD officer Nathan Heidelberg in March 2019. In chronological order, 1. The New Jersey Alarm Monitoring Company's two representatives were not specific when calling Midland's 911 about whether they would repeatedly try to contact Wilson when his pool overhead door alarm sounded in their office. 2. The City of Midland 911 dispatcher used a routine phrase, ATCKC, attempted to contact key carrier when calling MPD, when in fact she did not know if that was actually happening. As it turns out, Wilson was never contacted by the NJ monitoring firm. 9/11 supervisor Angela Wolf explained that their office would have no phone number available. Operator would just dispatch police to address and provide name of homeowners. Because of MPD policy changes after this event, dispatch now notifies police if the key carrier answers or not. Wolf said that officers will only respond to alarm calls when the key carrier answers or if someone actually sees a burglar. Otherwise, police will drive by the location when convenient to check for forced entry. 3. Heidelberg was inadvertently exposed in front of the unsecured door of the residence as he shone his flashlight inside and announced the presence of the police, a point also talked about earlier in the week. From PPO Victoria Alley's explanation of her body camera on the first day, Officer Heidelberg makes loud announcement and is facing entry full on. 4. Front door was not secured and Wilson shot before ascertaining who was at the door. Prosecutors questioned a series of police officers who arrived on scene March 5th. One of the patrol supervisors at the time, Sergeant Anthony Corson, was asked if, after reviewing PPO Alley's body camera footage, he would have done anything differently, to which he responded, "Not a thing." The defense attorney asked him if neighbors had come outside to investigate, and he said no. He then asked Corson if he was the one to command Wilson to come out of the house, and if the defendant followed all the instructions exactly. To that, he replied, yes. Another expert witness for the state, Howard Ryan, is a crime scene and shooting incident reconstruction consultant with 25 years of experience as a New Jersey state police officer. He explained that he looks at the evidence left behind, the path of the bullet when it strikes someone or something from the shooter's standpoint, and at the wound tracks when he is reconstructing an incident. He said this case was a little different because you had exceptional video with multiple screens and camera angles. He told the jury that he looks at the movement of people prior, during, and after gunfire. He's been taught to consider the psychological element, including the presence of outside factors known as bias, which affects the shooter's decision-making. He further analyzes the threat, which he explained as, did someone perceive a threat and did that affect the response? Judge Tyron Lewis sustained the defense's objections to Ryan's expertise in the area of state of mind. Therefore, the jury was shown the three-screen video prepared by Texas Rangers again, and Mr. Ryan was limited to stating his observations of the defendant's journey through the house, his haste to retrieve the gun, his stance while shooting, and his attempts to clear the jam after the first shot. On cross-examination, Ryan was shown photos of the actual front doors and the opaque glass inserts in them. He stated that light from flashlights would penetrate but not come through such glass in detail. He also mentioned that Wilson would not have had the infrared eyesight that his night vision cameras portrayed. The state's last witness, a physician, was in surgery and unavailable until Monday. WTX Manifest organizers have high hopes for festival. 30 bands to participate in Crane County's newest musical event by J.C. Lewis. Crane County might not be on people's radars for a musical festival, but Oscar Aguilar wants to change that mindset. WTX Manifest will bring 30 bands from rock, country, hip-hop, Latin, indie, and pop genres to West Texas from October 21st to the 23rd, 2022. Aguilar, the Planmaster's GPS owner and president, has been involved with planning large-scale conferences, conventions, and parades that usually end with concerts in Dallas. He said over the phone that he received an opportunity from a landowner in May about hosting a musical festival in Crane County. The landowner asked if they could provide a venue for us if we would be able to host a music festival, said Aguilar, who is originally from Odessa and moved to the Dallas-Fort Worth area about 23 years ago. He has land outside of town and was wanting to do something similar to other major music festivals. Aguilar said he wasn't initially sold on the idea until he went out to see the property that was in Crane County. I'd been to Crane in the past and thought it wasn't going to work with the traffic, he said. However, when he saw the beautiful piece of property, which is surrounded by plateaus, he was sold. Now the layout of the festival is being designed and construction will start in the new year. The festival is also trying to attract sponsors who can get in on the ground level. The amount of land available to the festival will also allow the event to grow in years to come. The event will have local and national coverage, partly thanks to the festival partnering with Ticketmaster. Lollapalooza started small, but now it's a huge festival. The target demographic is 18 to 20-year-olds. We want to make the event accessible to students at colleges and universities. During the festival, local nonprofits, including Oilfield Helping Hands, West Texas Gifts of Hope, and Odessa Arts, will be featured each day at the event. WTX Manifest will then match up to $10,000 in total donations. Featured nonprofits will be provided a booth that will encourage attendees to donate either at the booth or through the festival app. This will be a music and culture event, and by culture, we want to incorporate art as well. We want to promote the many talented artists in the area. We also want to enhance the culture that is already here. The lineup of bands will be announced in the spring. The music festival is also working to have a tight security and accommodations for those traveling to the festival. The festival will have a pop-up general store for overnight campers to purchase snacks, toiletries, and other basic essentials. Festival credentials will be in the form of chipped bracelets, which will be mailed out to attendees in the months leading up to the event or available for will call at the box office on site. The appeal of the location is the ability to camp or glamour camp among the plateaus. West Texas has the most beautiful sunsets. We are further away from big cities, which means nighttime will be a great time to stargaze at the beautiful clear skies. The event will be mostly cashless with chipped bracelets that can be tied to banking accounts or credit cards to make payments at food and drink vendors. There will be lockers on site, free phone charging stations, and free water fill stations. Overnight campers will have access to showers and restrooms with upgraded private showers and restrooms for glampers. The glamping area will feature a butler service. The festival will utilize RV parks close to the fairgrounds to resupply ice needs for vendors and overnight campers. There will be a food court, community fire pits, and a barbecue area for overnight campers, as well as food trucks and entertainment sections for events outside the festival schedule. There will be 24/7 security during the event for parking, fairgrounds, and camping grounds. A shuttle service will be provided from Monahans, Fort Stockton, and Odessa for those that prefer not to drive. Pricing and location to be released on the website. Individuals can purchase a 3-day general, VIP, or ultra VIP ticket package at a special discounted rate with the promo code LAUNCH2021 for a limited time. Once the festival lineup is announced, individual festival tickets will take place through an early bird sale. Woman held on $1 million bond at county jail. A Midland woman charged with capital murder and the death of her newborn is being held in Midland County Jail on a $1 million bond. Megan Crawley, 31, was charged after her newborn was found Tuesday in plastic trash bags in the trunk of her car. Crawley was at MMH for a dilation and curettage procedure when doctors contacted police that she did not have any recollection of giving birth. Doctors estimated she had given birth about 4 days prior, according to the arrest affidavit, as they removed a placenta the size of at least a 36-week gestational period. After coming out of anesthesia, she stated she did, and her husband did not, she said she nor her husband even wanted kids. Midland Police Department detectives received consent to search the home for Collie's fiancé. While en route to the house, the fiancé received a text message from Collie stating, "I love you. I messed up. Trunk of the Impala. They won't have to check the house. It was already dead. I'm going to jail for life." After obtaining a search warrant and her statement, Collie admitted to having the infant on November 26th. She also said she placed the infant in several plastic bags and placed him in the trunk of her car. Collie denied that the infant was alive when he was born. Paramedics on the scene stated the infant was breathing prior to being placed inside the plastic bags. Apartment rents in the area are well below Texas metros. By Stuart Doreen. Rents in Midland, Odessa continued to trail those around the region and remained well behind the metropolitan areas up and down Interstate 35 and 45. ApartmentList.com reported average rents in Midland of $685 for a one-bedroom apartment and $837 for a two-bedroom. While the averages were greater than Odessa, home of the lowest rents of larger metropolitan communities in the state, they trailed those elsewhere in the region, including Lubbock, San Angelo, and Abilene. The rents were down 1%. A month over month, but up 3.5% year over year in Midland. Since March 2020, the average rent in Midland is down 25%, one of the largest declines in the nation, according to Apartment List. Oil companies showed the largest declines going back to the start of the pandemic in Odessa. The decline was 27% in Williston, North Dakota, another community in an oil patch. The highest average rents across the state were in the Metroplex, including $2,000 in Flower Mound. Nationally, Apartment List reports that rent growth is flattening out across the U.S. In November, its national rent index increased a marginal 0.1%, the lowest growth rate measured all year. Gas prices decrease in the area. Mr. Stuart Doreen. Oil prices dropped, and so did gas prices. That was true in Midland and across the state. In Midland, the price fell 4 cents over the past 2 weeks. That puts the average price here 12 cents higher than the state average. The average in Midland is the second highest in the state, behind the average in El Paso. Odessa, Texarkana, and College Station round out the top five. Overall, AAA Texas reported that 8 metropolitan areas showed prices at or above $3. The state average is down 5 cents in the last 2 weeks. Gasoline prices across much of the state are reversing their upward trend thanks to decreasing demand and falling crude oil prices. But it's too soon to tell if fears of a global economic slowdown caused by the Omicron variant will push oil prices lower for the long term. Averages across the region are at least 15 cents lower than in Midland, Odessa. The average in Midland is up $1.11 compared to the same time in 2020. The average year-over-year price in Texas is up $1.13. Oil supply and demand headed for a balanced 2022 by Mella McEwen. Renewed concern about COVID-19, with the emergence and rise of the Omicron variant and its impact on world oil demand continued to weigh on oil markets. West Texas Intermediate, which plunged $10 the Friday after Thanksgiving, struggled to rebound this week, rising only 2 of 5 trading days on the New York Merc. After opening the trading week with a $1.80 gain, prices followed with a 377 decline that Thursday's 93% rise could not overcome. Prices ended the week at $66.26, down 24 cents for the day and below the $69.95 at Monday's close. The posted price ended the week at $62.74, according to Plains All American. Oil prices fell 2.8% for the week and marked the 6th consecutive weekly decline. Natural gas prices endured a rough week, rising only 1 of 5 trading days. Henry Hub started the week by plunging 62 cents, followed by a 29-cent drop Tuesday, a 31-cent fall Wednesday, and 20 cents on Thursday. Prices closed at 4.132 per MCF, down 4.854. John Pasey, president of Stratus Advisors, noted to the Reporter Telegram that concerns about the virus had European countries implementing lockdowns even before the Omicron variant emerged, and that Asian countries like China had also become cautious. "I really think this is a short-term glitch," he said, of the market's recent volatility. "Based on what we're hearing, the new variant won't be as bad as Delta, and hopefully governments won't overreact." But there were other factors affecting oil prices, including a strengthening U.S. dollar and the Federal Reserve's intention to move forward with tighter credit policies more quickly than anticipated. On the other hand, there is still some strength in the U.S. economy. Stratus had been more bullish than some other analysts on oil prices, but Pasey dismissed predictions from J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs that prices could reach $100 to $120 a barrel, saying he sees no factors that could cause such a spike. His company is sticking with its forecast of averaging $78 a barrel in 2022 and natural gas prices averaging $4.22 per MCF. As long as shale operators steadily increase production and don't have a huge ramp up, prices should hold to that forecast. OPEC Plus is managing the market and managing supplies. They won't want a very low price or to lose market share. Rising oil demand should give producers room to add supply without impacting prices, predicting that oil supply and demand should be relatively balanced next year. Natural gas markets have gotten overheated recently and driving prices above $6 per MCF. But conditions remain favorable for natural gas, given the return of demand and growth in exports of U.S. natural gas to Europe and Asia. ConocoPhillips purchase complete. ConocoPhillips this week completed its acquisition of Shell Enterprises Delaware Basin Holdings for $9.5 billion in cash, which had been announced in September. The assets purchased include 225,000 net acres and producing properties in West Texas, as well as more than 600 miles of operated crude, gas, and water pipelines and infrastructure. Existing production is around 175,000 barrels of oil equivalent per day, and ConocoPhillips estimated that would be 200 BOED in 2022, roughly half of which will be operated. The majority of Shell's Midland-based Permian employees and many Houston-based employees were offered jobs by ConocoPhillips, effective with the closing of the deal. This deal was justified on 3 key merits. It meets our rigorous cost of supply framework. We see a way to drive efficiencies from the assets, and the transaction makes our 10-year plan better, said Ryan Lance, Chairman and Chief Exec Officer of ConocoPhillips. "We believe the addition of these high-quality assets improves our underlying business drivers, expands our cash operations, and enhances our ability to deliver higher returns on and of capital," and lowers our average GHG intensity. For its part, Shell commented that the deal reflects Shell's focus on value over volumes, as well as disciplined stewardship of capital. This transaction was made possible by the Permian's team's outstanding operational performance and provides excellent value to our shareholders through accelerated cash delivery and additional distributions. As previously announced, Shell said the cash proceeds from this transaction will be used to fund $7 billion in additional shareholder distributions, with the remainder used for further strengthening of the balance sheet. The first tranche of additional shareholder distributions will be in the form of share buybacks of up to $1.5 billion and commenced on December 2nd. Permian Basin counties account for 8 of top 10 in state oil output. 8 Permian Basin counties combined to make up nearly 55% of the statewide production of oil in September, according to the preliminary reported totals from the Railroad Commission of Texas. Midland County again led the state with over 14 million barrels, or 13.5% of the 104 million barrels produced in September, according to the RRC. Midland and Martin County were numbers 1 and 2 in the state. The RRC reported 12.96 million barrels were produced in Martin County during the month of September. The other Permian Basin counties in the top 10 were Howard, Upton, Reeves, Loving, Reagan, and Andrews. All 8 counties combined for 55% of the total production. In terms of natural gas production, 2 Permian Basin counties finished in the top 3 during the month. Reeves again dominated other counties. Midland was 3rd with, and preliminary figures show 750 billion cubic feet reported across the state. In September 2020, the preliminary production of crude oil was 104 million barrels. The updated total was 117 million. During the same month, the preliminary production of gas was 745 billion cubic feet. The updated total was 853 billion cubic feet. Oversized load strikes bridge. Eastbound Interstate 20 in Midland County was down to one lane Friday after an oversized load caused damage to multiple overpasses on Thursday. TxDOT shut down various lanes Thursday after an oversized load damaged the Midkiff Road overpass. The overpass remained closed. The oversized load also hit the overpasses at Cotton Flat and Lamesa Road, causing minor damage. I-20 was down to one lane as crews cleaned up and assessed damage of the overpasses. Wes Jr. pleads guilty to murder that began as a missing persons case. Midland County District Attorney Laura Nodoff announced that a 19-year-old Midland man entered a guilty plea to a charge of murder late Thursday and was sentenced to 35 years in prison. The case involved a 2019 Midland County shooting that started as a missing persons investigation. Larry Allen West Jr., 19, was originally charged with capital murder. Through a plea agreement with the district attorney's office, West, who was 17 at the time of the killing, was found guilty of murder and waived his right to appeal in exchange for a recommended punishment of 35 years in prison. A news release also stated that West's co-defendant, Zayden Logan Hayes, was assessed 99 years in prison by a jury after a trial in October. That case is currently on appeal. The evidence presented in Hayes' trial showed Hayes and West were involved in an attempted robbery as part of a plan to get marijuana on December 27, 2019. A 17-year-old student, Robert Duncan, was shot and killed by Hayes after West, knowing Hayes was carrying a gun, snatched a quantity of marijuana away from the victim and attempted to escape. The DA's office alleged West was guilty of the killing as a knowing party to the attempted robbery, despite not being the shooter. West and Hayes left the victim for dead at the rural location just south of Love's truck stop at the intersection of Loop 250 and Interstate 20. Duncan's disappearance was originally investigated as a missing person case until New Year's Eve, when his body was finally located on the property of a small RV park. The investigation by the Midland County Sheriff's Office resulted in felony charges against a total of 4 individuals in connection with Duncan's death. At this time, 2 cases are still pending trial. Because of the offense was committed when West was 17 years of age, the death penalty was never a possibility. And because of his age, West would have been eligible for parole, even if convicted of capital murder. Under the law, he cannot be considered for parole until he has served at least half of the sentence. The case was prosecuted by Midland County First Assistant District Attorney Tim Flathers and Assistant DA Libby Richards. Jerome Dade Green passed away on November 24th. Celebration of life service will be at 3 o'clock p.m. Tuesday, December 7th at St. Luke's United Methodist Church. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Ray Jones Willis Jr. passed away on December 2nd. The family will receive friends on Tuesday, December 7th from 5 to 7 p.m. at Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Memorial service will be held on Wednesday, December 8th at 1 p.m. at Holy Trinity Episcopal Church in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Graveside service for Robert R. Pringle of La Mesa will be held Tuesday, December 7th at 1 p.m. at Rest Haven Memorial Park in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Branham Funeral Home. Visitation will be held Monday, December 6th from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Branham Funeral Home. William G. Kern passed away on Saturday, November 13th. No services have been announced at this time. Gayla Morris passed away on December 3rd. Funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, December 6th at Kelview Heights Baptist Church. Arrangements are under the direction of Nellie Pickle and Welsh Funeral Home. Nolan Wayne McMarion passed away on November 27th. Viewing will be held Monday, December 6th from 1 to 9 p.m. at Luella Garcia Pipkin Funeral Home. Funeral service will be Tuesday, December 7th at 10 a.m. at Goodwill Baptist Church. A graveside service will follow at 3 p.m. at Garden of Memories Cemetery in McCamey. William L. Bates passed away on November 28th. Viewing will be Sunday, December 5th from 3 to 5 p.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Home. Funeral service will take place on Monday, December 6th at 11 a.m. at Avalos Sanchez and Thomas Funeral Chapel.
Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Odessa American for Saturday, December 4th. Social Work Program Building at UTPB by Ruth Campbell. University of Texas Permian Basin student Letitia Harrow said what drew her to study social work is that it matches her values of striving for social justice, human rights, and human dignity. Harrow, who will graduate in May with a bachelor's degree in social work, said she has been interested in the field from a young age. Harrow tried nursing and psychology, but feels she has found her niche. After completing her bachelor's degree, Harrow plans to earn a master's degree in clinical social work and work in mental health before returning to UTPB to work as an educator. A single mother of 3 children, one of whom is grown, Harrow is from Big Spring. She has lived in Odessa for more than 10 years. Along with mental health, there are a variety of areas social workers can go into, from hospitals to criminal justice. If there's a human being in the mix, there can be a social worker. So it is a pretty broad area of practice, said Sam Terrazas, academic chair and professor of social work. Terrazas said the values of social work drive its practice. We're very much rooted in social justice kinds of issues, which include making sure people have their basic needs met, Terrazas said. Social workers can be found in sports, working for the FBI in forensics, or in psychotherapy, for example. In reality, social workers provide most of the psychotherapy in the United States. When you look at it statistically for the psychologist, more than psychiatrist, so that's a misnomer as well. As an undergraduate, you do the kinds of things related more to case management. I don't want to put that in a box, but that's what it looks like. But as a master's degree social worker, you can do things like clinical social work, but also administration, research, policy, advocacy, community organizing. It really branches out into other kinds of services for people that may be more specialized, Terrazas said. Bachelor of Social Work students are trained to be generalist practitioners, and someone with a master's in social work has a wider range of specializations, he added. UTPB's social work program currently has a little more than 30 students, but it is growing. We're a small program, but we are steadily growing, Terrazas said. Director of Field Education Samantha Perales said she and Terrazas are trying to get the word out that social workers don't just handle child welfare issues or make referrals. A social work degree opens a wide range of possibilities. One of our values is that all people have dignity and worth, so we teach our students that as a way of understanding that interpersonal context when they work with others, Terrazas said. Perales said they are working to provide students with interdisciplinary work. Because, of course, as Sam mentioned, we're going to be anywhere that there's humans. Sometimes we think of those settings as being a little atypical for a social worker, and so it's really important that we expose the students to those possibilities of things like interdisciplinary teams and looking holistically at the individual, Perales said. Terrazas said social workers can help people with the mental health and wellness aspects of postpartum depression and helping new fathers navigate that role. As part of the program, students do field practicums, working in areas from intimate partner violence to mental health and substance abuse. Harrow works with First Five Permian Basin's Parents as Teachers program. They offer home visiting services for families, and it's focused on early education for children ages 2 to 5 years old. But there's also the HIPPE program, which is kindergarten readiness for toddlers. And they have the Nurse Family Partnership. That helps first-time moms. They're assigned a registered nurse that helps guide them through the process, their pregnancy, and after having their child, up to the age of 2 years old, Harrow said. Terrazas said all fourth-year students have to do an average of 16 hours a week in actual practice of an agency. Rather than the traditional internship, she's not stapling papers or whatever, she actually has to practice and actually do social work within that agency, Terrazas said. Our social work, just like other health or applied disciplines, is competency-based. So Letitia gets to be assessed on 9 different competencies of practice. In the midterm, Samantha goes out and says, "Hey, how's Letitia doing?" But not just generally. She looks at those 9 competencies, and her supervisor has to say, "Yes, Letitia to a degree, and if she's not, which she is, she's one of our top students. But if she's not able to do that, then technically she cannot finish our program, just like any other applied profession," Terrazas said. He added that social work is guided by ethics, values, and competencies. Perales oversees seniors in the final year of their practicum. Perales said she meets with the students if they have met a certain amount of their degree. If they've met their practice courses, then we can put them into the field practicum placement. I will then work with a student on interest as far as what they're interested in doing with their social work degree. And then we will go through the avenues of community agencies and locating social workers that are already in practice that can supervise our students while they're in this practicum year. My job really is to ensure that the students have this connection between what they've learned from us through the program on this theoretical approach or in these practice courses into applied practice out in the community, And so I will work with them and work with their agencies to make sure that these competencies that they've learned with us are translating well into what client interaction looks like, Perales said. Perales said this is her first year as director of field education. One of the things she is enjoying is helping students figure out what their post-graduation looks like, whether it's graduate school, talking to recruiters, or emphasizing the importance of getting a social work license. That is also something that we're trying to do, get out in the community, is that we are a protected profession. We have a licensure for practice, and it's important that I expose that and we get the students prepared for holding a license to practice in the state of Texas, Perales said. Licenses are obtained through the Texas Department of State Health Services. There also are master's level licenses for licensed clinical social workers. Terraza said this allows them to work in a private practice or hang out their own shingle. Terraza said the program is accredited by the Council on Social Work Education, which drives the competencies and shows that graduates are ready to practice. The licensure part says the state now recognizes that you are ready to practice. Students take a national test, but every state has different licensure requirements. Harrow said she has not started studying for the exam yet, but Perales said Harrow will undergo a crash course in the spring semester. Harrow said applying her academic experience to the real world has been enjoyable. I feel like Ms. Perales has really prepared us, Harrow said. Harrow said she has noticed that Terraza's approach has been innovative and creative, and she feels like there's more of a connection between faculty and students. Terraza said he feels that connection is important because we are professional, so there's also a mentorship aspect of it. He added that Harrow is an outstanding student. Letitia and I have talked about graduate school. We've talked about doctoral studies. We've talked about what the profession looks like for her down the road, just like Samantha has in practice. So that relationship and those conversations are really important beyond the academics, Terraza added. Generally speaking, he said a lot of the students are first-generation college students, so they don't think about going to graduate school and may have never considered it. This makes that educator-student connection even more important. Samantha and I have worked really, really hard with changing the culture of our department to one where students understand that we are here for them academically, but also to prepare them for the professional social work, Terraza said. Harrow, who has a 20-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 4-year-old, has to juggle her life along with schoolwork. She said she is able to do so because she has a lot of family support. I've got both of my parents nearby and my siblings as well. Without that, I don't think I would be successful, Harrow said. To further bolster student training, the department has set up a family services simulation laboratory. The idea is to help students learn how to practice social work in a quasi-real environment. We will run students through this, just like they do in nursing, and we'll get them certain scenarios, Terraza said. We prepare the simulation, we give the people their roles, and the student has to come in and be able to accurately and properly intervene with alleged child abuse. They are mandated reporters, so that's something they have to do, Terraza said. This is really the way to prepare practitioners for the field and the profession, because it gives them the opportunity to mess up, he added. So Terraza can look at how things are going and stop it. That can't be done in the field. It takes this program to the next level because we believe our clients deserve the most qualified, most competent social workers that we can prepare for the profession, he said. The program also has a virtual presence technology, which can be used for clients in rural settings. Our dean, Dr. Donna Buke, funded us to buy this device over here. We're using it to train our students to use virtual presence technology in contexts where they can't be. It's basically telemedicine, but using a robot, Terraza said. Top Lawmen Face Off for Charity by Royal McGregor. Ector County Sheriff Mike Griffiths and Odessa Police Department Chief Michael Gerke will again face off in the Battle of the Red Kettle Challenge. The two local lawmen will ring their bells from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. Saturday at the Walmart located at 4210 JBS Parkway. Gerke said the challenge is for bragging rights between the two local law enforcement agencies, but he explained the real winner is the Salvation Army. It's kind of grown into a friendly competition, but that I always lose, and Griffiths always wins, Gerke said. It's not about us. Every dime is going to the Salvation Army. Really, the Salvation Army wins. Griffiths said he is eager to compete against Gerke again. The Ector County Sheriff said the OPD chief brings out McGruff, the crime dog, and other props to attract more attention. I think he's going to bring out more of his props to raise more money than me, Griffiths said. Gerke corrected and said it was Paw Patrol last year, not McGruff the crime dog, and he said he might bring out those props again. We will probably do something like that again, Gerke said. Griffiths said the Ector County Sheriff's Office and the Odessa Police Department have a great relationship, and it's strengthened during the holiday season. It's a fun competition between friends, and it's for a good cause, Griffiths said. Gerke said the friendly competition started when he and Griffiths became advisory board members at the Salvation Army. He said this competition helps benefit the Salvation Army. Sheriff's Office Implements Gun Program by Royal McGregor. When Mike Griffiths took over as Ector County Sheriff in the beginning of 2017, he said he had major goals he wanted to achieve for the department. The first of those goals was better pay for his staff. The second was the start of a take-home fleet. The final, which began a couple weeks ago, is a unified firearms program. In today's day and time, I think it's very important that everybody has the same weapon, same magazine, and same ammunition, Griffiths said. God forbid, if somebody was in a bind and they needed another magazine or another gun, everything would be interchangeable. All personnel at the Ector County Sheriff's Office are receiving a Glock 45 that comes with a Streamlight TLR-7, three magazines, a holster, and magazine pouches. There's also an option for MOS site. The firearms were purchased with seizure and donated funds. Prior to the firearms programs, personnel had to supply their own firearm. A majority of agencies in the United States have been issuing service weapons for many years, Griffiths said. We haven't been able to do that before due to budget constraints. We've been blessed in the last couple of years with seizure funds and donated funds, and we were able to purchase weapons for everybody instead of having them furnish their own weapon. Lieutenant Thomas Paz said the sheriff's office has purchased 200 firearms. As of Friday morning, Paz said there's about 30 to 40 firearms that still need to be issued to sheriff's office personnel. Paz said that's one patrol shift and two jail shifts. They are excited about it, Paz said about the firearms. Of course, it's hard to accept change, especially the ones who didn't carry Glocks before. It's going to take repetitions to get used to it. Across the board, they are excited about it. Griffiths hopes with incremental improvements to the sheriff's office that it will continue to help with retraining and recruiting. Griffiths said he wants to continue fighting for better pay for his personnel. I wanted to get the pay competitive, and we've done that. But we need to work on that some more, Griffiths said. I told some members of the court a couple of years ago that there will come a time where you're going to have to pay peace officers more than you pay anyone else in local government just to get them to take the job. That was a couple of years ago, and we are here now. Ireland Elementary closes. As a precaution, Ireland Elementary, 4301 Dawn Avenue, was closed part of Friday. Parents were asked to pick up their children by noon, at which time any students still on campus were bused to Ross Elementary to await pickup by their parents. Over the past 3 days, a news release stated, Ireland staff and students have reported the smell of gas inside the building at different times, and several have become ill. Odessa Fire and Rescue and Atmos were on campus multiple times to conduct inspections and did not find any problems with the heating and ventilation systems. At this time, the district does not have a reason to explain the illnesses, so in order to be cautious, classes were dismissed for the rest of Friday. Additional inspections of the building and the area were expected Friday afternoon. It is expected school would be back in session on Monday. U.S. jobless rate sinks to 4.2% as many more people find jobs. The Associated Press, Washington. America's unemployment rate tumbled last month to its lowest point since the pandemic struck, even as employers appeared to slow their hiring. A mixed picture that pointed to a resilient economy that's putting more people to work. The government reported Friday that businesses and other employers added just 210,000 jobs in November, the weakest monthly gain in nearly a year, and less than half of October's increase of 546,000. But other data from the Labor Department's report painted a brighter picture. The unemployment rate plummeted from 4.6% to 4.2% as a substantial 1.1 million Americans said they found jobs last month. The U.S. economy still remains under threat from a spike in inflation, shortages of labor and supplies, and the potential impact of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus. But for now, Americans are spending freely, and the economy is forecast to expand at a 7% annual rate in the final 3 months of the year, a sharp rebound from the 2.1% pace in the previous quarter, when the Delta variant hobbled growth. Employers in some industries, such as restaurants, bars, and hotels, pulled back on hiring in November. By contrast, job growth remained solid in areas like transportation and warehousing, which are benefiting from the growth of online commerce. Death notices from the Odessa American for Saturday. Maria Guadalupe Jacques, 93, died Thursday, December 2nd in Odessa. Services are pending with Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Ian Conrad Pando, 20, of Odessa, died Monday, November 29th in Odessa. Funeral service will be held at 2 p.m. Wednesday, December 8th at Acres West Funeral Chapel. Burial to follow at American Heritage Cemetery. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Orlando Lando Porras, 59, died Tuesday, November 30th in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa. Ismael Sanchez, 72, died Wednesday, December 1st in Odessa. Services are pending with Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home of Odessa. David B. Valencia, Jr., 52, of Odessa, died Monday, November 29th in Arlington. Mass will be celebrated at 10 a.m. on Monday, December 6th, 20 St. Joseph Catholic Church. Burial will follow at the Rose Hill section of Ector County Cemetery. The family will receive friends on Sunday, December 5th from noon to 9 p.m., with a rosary at 7 p.m., Arrangements are by Hubbard Kelly Funeral Home of Odessa. Hello, this is Cindy reading from the Odessa American for Sunday, December 5th. ECISD Survey, Most NICs New Taxes, by Ruth Campbell. Results from a recent survey on Ector County ISD's proposed bond election yielded grim results. Conducted by Baselease and Associates November 2nd through the 14th, the poll of 1,000 Ector County voters shows 39% are for and 54% are against a school bond of $600 million. An amount has not been set, and the Bond Planning Committee is still working out a recommendation to bring to the Ector County ISD Board of Trustees. Bond Planning Committee co-chair Lorraine Perriman said they will meet Monday and Tuesday to take a deep dive into the survey data and any information the group wants to know more about. Perriman said the committee was very disappointed in the survey results. There's a lot to digest there, and it's very concerning, she said. There are lots of people that know that there are real needs, but they don't want their taxes raised to pay for it, Perryman said. You can't have your cake and eat it, too. Kids are bursting at the seams. We can't just build to accommodate what we have. We have to accommodate future growth as well. That's the only way in taxes that you pay for that is bond elections. That money does not come from the state. But you have people that always, unfortunately, have that anti-tax sentiment, even though they recognize that we have growth and will have student growth in the future, Perryman said. Bass Lee spoke with 400 voters and 600 voters filled out an online survey. The survey showed people need more information, and while they recognize the needs of the district, they don't want their taxes to increase. They also don't have a good perception of the district's academic performance and operations. The poll took on the phone 15 or 20 minutes, so it was a lengthy phone conversation because there were over 30 questions that were asked, and some of the questions required quite a bit of explanation for the voter, Superintendent Scott Murray said. Murray said he appreciates residents for participating. The high school takeaway was that our community overwhelmingly supports the creation of a new high school in Ector County. That was very clear through the polling information. They do not want large high schools, and that was very evident. The community understands the needs for repairs, upkeep, and maintenance of our schools. That was very clear. The community recognizes the value of technology and education. That was very clear as well. And that's technology infrastructure as well as tools for kids. The community supports the fine and performing arts and believes that investments in those areas are wise as we develop our students. The community supported a career and technical education center. They, again, understand the need that we have within our community to support kids and their CTE pathways, Murray said. The community didn't support continued investments in athletics, and so Ratliff Stadium, it was really clear that investing dollars in that complex was not supported within our community. Some of the other athletic upgrades to campuses were not supported in our community, Murray said. And so, again, we will have to listen to that. Our voters, or at least those that were polled, challenge our system to be better, Murray added. There has also been discontent with the additions to Permian and Odessa high schools from the previous bond, where fewer classrooms than expected were added. I think, again, we have to do a better job as a system of education, educating our community and the needs of our organization, and then how we've used the bond dollars in the past. And also, it was clear, helping people understand the difference between a bond and the dollars that you get from a TRE go into your general fund, and those dollars can be used to increase teacher salaries. And really, thanks to our community, the passage of a TRE in 2017, that is how we have been able to increase teacher salaries. But a bond referendum does not go into your general fund. Those dollars are only used to build new facilities or to renovate facilities or to invest in the infrastructure of the school system, Murray said. The proceeds can also be used for repairs. But because our facilities are so old now, the dollar amount for repairs right now is $175 million, just over the next 5 years. The average age of a school in ECISD is 61 years old. When you begin to get a little older, kind of like our bodies, as we age, we need a little bit more medical care, and it costs more money. 31 of our schools are over 60 years of age, so we have a lot of schools that need significant attention, either to repair them or replace them, depending upon how severe their condition is. And our public doesn't seem to understand that. We take the blame for that. We must do a better job of educating our public in that area, Murray said. He added that nobody wants their taxes increased. But from a school district perspective, I think we have to think about our children. This is an opportunity to invest in the education of our children. If I think about it just as a tax increase, that gives, even for me, a bad taste in my mouth. But an investment in your school district is an investment in the children of our community. And we have 32,000 of them that will eventually become the next superintendent, the next reporter, the next teacher, etc., Murray said. While it would be a tax increase, it is an investment in students and the community to help make students competitive. If we don't want that, then our kids are going to struggle to be competitive in this global economy, Murray said. Murray said the district has different fundraising opportunities from colleges and universities, and it cannot use elementary and secondary school emergency relief or American Rescue Plan funds for buildings. The city and county have received ARP funds, and the school district has requested some of that money to provide affordable high-speed broadband to everyone in Ector County that wants it. It can use some ESSER funds if it wanted to install new HVAC systems in schools, but it has to be used for COVID-related purposes. Primarily, the ESSER funds are for academic recovery, Murray said. The district can apply for and be awarded grants, but in smaller amounts. For example, the FMH Foundation recently awarded ECISD $550,000 to go toward fine and performing arts. Until a bond recommendation goes to the school board, there is no political action committee. The PAC will make a case to the community for a bond. The district has an information function, but they can only deal in facts. They can't lobby one way or the other, Perryman said. There are big decisions to be made with some negative attitude in the community should this go forward. That's one of the reasons we're doing these two deep dive meetings, so that's lots of these questions and extra data can be gotten to answer those questions. Then the district has to deal with the image that they have in the community. The school board and the school district has to deal with that. That is not what a political action committee does to pass a bond election. Our job is not to fix people's negative impressions of the school district, but it is important that the school district knows what community attitudes were in the survey and that they respond to those and address the needs that the community has. That's not the bond committee's job to do that. The district does need to do that, Perryman said. She said she was surprised by some survey results and not surprised by others. Perryman added that there is a lot of discontent in the world right now and in the community. I think that we see that mirrored when we ask people about local issues. There's a lot of frustration, and I'm not saying this just about this survey. I'm saying in the general community. People can recognize problems, but I think we live in a world that's pretty overwhelming right now. We think we're getting out of this pandemic, and then a new variant emerges, and we're back in. So we're still in a pandemic, and everybody wants that to be over for a million reasons, mostly the preservation of human life. But it also has a huge impact on all of our communities in many ways, our kids, their future, the future of the community, the economy, Perryman said. People are also tiring of the pandemic. Issues such as increased inflation and supply chain bottlenecks have come up because of COVID. She acknowledged that things are tough right now and it's a tough time to sell a bond, but they can't just stall out. We have to meet the needs of today and the future, she said. Many of our elementary schools are over capacity. Our middle schools are crowded, and some are beyond their life cycle, and then it's just a money pit. They need to be replaced. It's the same as you deal with in your own personal residence. You've got to take care of it, and that's where we are. Sometimes you need to replace it. So there are those issues at the middle school, overcrowding at every level, and the oil industry is back, Perryman said. We as a community need to take a deep breath and try to do right by our kids within the constraints that we all feel on our pocketbooks, and the personal impact of the pandemic. So there's a lot going on, Perryman added. She said she has been very pleased with the bond committee, which is made up of a cross-section of community members, including ECISD teachers and principals. they are very conscientious and they are taking all of these issues into account. They are not looking at any of this in a cavalier way. They are recognizing the constraints in the community and the problems that people in the community face because of all these issues that are not of Odessa's making. But we have to make Odessa strong for the future as well. It's a balancing act, and it's up to the community to decide what they want, Perriman said. The proposal that will come from the committee has gone through a very deliberative process, she said. The committee has looked at every issue that they can think of and have debated and prayed about what is the best thing for Odessa. The final decisions are not made yet, so there is still work ahead, and we have these two deep dive meetings to delve into these hard questions, and then we have one more bond meeting on the December 16th. Out of that, a proposal will be derived to go to the school board. Then they're the ones that have to make that decision. It's not a perfect environment to do this in, but we can't just be frozen as a community because we're facing a lot of challenges, Perriman added. Asked about the perception that a lot of people on the committee are comfortable and may be out of touch, Perriman said the committee is very cognizant of that, and there are a lot of people on it who are not wealthy. There are parents of children from pretty much every school in Ector County, so they're living it every day. There are teachers on that committee. There are lots of people that are not immune to the hardships that people are facing right now. So I think there is a pretty good representation. Now there are those that are not as impacted, but there certainly are people that are struggling economically on the committee as well. The district invited people from all walks of life, from all parts of town, because it's not going to work otherwise, she said. She noted that she has not noticed that out-of-touch attitude on the committee because even the ones that are doing well do work in the community, like volunteering at the West Texas Food Bank. So I think there are people that may appear to be fine, but that doesn't mean they don't have a heart, and they don't see what's going on out there. I think the people are very heartfelt and have real honest concern for all of our children. I know I do. Murray said the bond planning committee will have its final meeting December 16th, and at that point, they'll make a decision whether to take a recommendation to the school board. That recommendation will come in January, and then the school board will spend about 5 weeks determining whether or not to call an election. Their deadline to call the election is the middle of February, and then we would target May of 2022 for an election, Murray said. He added that it's totally up to the Board of Trustees whether to move forward with an election. He said the survey helped the district know what the public wants. And the public wants a new high school. The public wants a CTE facility. The public wants investments in fine and performing arts. The public wants investments in technology. So those are things that through the survey the public told us, and we need to pay attention to those things because, again, our parents and other community members see value in those items. And obviously, we would need to see those in a bond. The public also sees that we're growing and we have to take care of the growth of our school system. We have schools, and our parents can tell you this, that are bursting at the seams. When you walk through our two large comprehensive high schools, there's not a lot of elbow room. We have elementary and middle schools that are just like that, Murray said. Murray said he was not surprised that people didn't want any new taxes. I've been around in education for a long time and have been a part of multiple bonds. I don't think anybody wants a new tax. But I think we have to see this as an investment in children. That's what it is. We have 32,000 children in our community that deserve investment. And how much do we value our children? And so a bond opportunity from a school system perspective demonstrates to our children how much we value their education, he said.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.